Welcome once again to our program, Reasons to Believe, or Catholic Apologetics, or Fundamental Theology. My guest, as usual, is Ron Eldred, who is Professor of Church History and World History at John Paul II and American History at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Church here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock is at the intersection of the street. Ron, perhaps we could do a little summary of what we've done up to this time. I believe this is our 12th session on apologetics, our the reasonableness of believing in God and believing in Jesus and in believing in the church, good reasons for doing that. Could you give us a little summary of where, how far we've come up to this time?
Yes, what we have sought to do is to make it reasonable to believe, or at least present the arguments that the church has proposed over the last couple of thousand years to make it reasonable to believe that the that God exists. Because all other doctrines of the Catholic Church or the Catholic faith matter only if he does exist. We are here talking about human reason to prove God's existence rather than relying on revelation. And we hope to prove that not only does God exist, but also something about the qualities that he possesses, known as his attributes or perfections. And we said that we can start out doing this simply by observing the universe that we live in, that is, God's creation, and reasoning to his existence. And philosophers and theologians have developed several arguments over the centuries using this line of reasoning. And we very briefly looked at the five arguments used by St. Thomas Aquinas back in the 13th century to prove God's existence. He was a Dominican priest, theologian, and philosopher who lived in the 13th century and who believed that human beings could reason from an observation of God's creation or nature to prove of his existence. And essentially, his five arguments can be broken down into two groups. And the first one is the argument of intelligent design. And then the second is the argument from causation, which four of these five arguments are examples.
Okay, could you just briefly remind us of what the argument for proving the existence of God from reason, from design, talks about?
Yes, design arguments are empirical arguments for God's existence. And by empirical is meant that they are observable by direct sense experience. In other words, we can see it or hear it or smell it or, you know, using our senses. And one using design arguments to prove God's existence usually progresses by identifying various observable features of the world that constitute evidence of intelligent design. And then they infer from this that God's existence is the best explanation for these features that they observe. Sometimes design arguments are called teleological arguments from the Greek telos, which means purpose, because the concepts of design and purpose are closely related. St. Thomas tells us that common sense tells us that the universe works in such a way that we can conclude that an intelligent designer, that is God, designed it. In other words, all physical laws in the order of nature and life were designed and ordered by God, the intelligent designer.
So it's basically, if there is a complicated watch, there has to be a watchmaker.
Yes. We didn't go into the details of that because that simply would take a lot of time. Plus, we almost need some kind of audiovisual aids and things of that sort to take a fairly complicated issue like that and present it.
Okay. Well, could we talk about St. Thomas's arguments from causation, which is another one of his strong reasoned arguments for the existence of God?
Well, as I said a while ago, four of his five arguments to prove God's existence are causation arguments. And the basic argument, though, is a simple one. We're not going to go into each specific argument. Again, that would take too much time and what have you. But the basic argument is, as I said, fairly simple. Everything has a reason or a cause for its existence. And nothing exists without cause. even the universe. Everything has to have a cause. You see, the first set of arguments dealing with design has to do with designing the universe. And then the second, the four, the causation arguments have to do with putting it into motion and to keep it in motion.
Or in existence.
Or in existence, yes. And with regard to the universe, it either had a beginning caused by something, that is a first cause or an uncaused cause, or sometimes a prime mover, whatever term that different philosophers have used over the centuries, that started the whole process in the first place. Or it is the result of some kind of infinite link of causes in a cosmic chain that has no beginning. In other words, what we're saying here is that either something has a cause or it doesn't have a cause. And there are some, the Catholic Church, of course, has always argued that everything has a cause, of course, and ultimately that cause, both the designer and the cause of putting it into motion, is God. There are, philosophers and even scientists, of course, who argue that things didn't really have any cause. It just sort of, it's just there. This infinite cosmic link is called an infinite regress of causes. In other words, it's an infinite link of causes of a cosmic chain that has no beginning. In other words, there never was a beginning. There was no designer. There was nothing to cause anything, to put anything into motion. That's basically the materialist or the atheistic.
And even argument. Those who say everything started with the Big Bang, whether it did or didn't, well, what caused the Big Bang?
Yes.
So we're back again. We have to have a cause for the things that are caused.
There had to be something to design it and to put it into motion, that is, to cause it to happen.
Okay. And you quoted that famous philosopher, what's his name, the modern guy, Keaton or...
Kreft. Peter Kreft.
Peter Kreft, yeah, who said that it would be like seeing a train of boxcars, and they're stationary, and suddenly they begin to move. Well, everybody knows that a boxcar can't move itself, so there's got to be an engine. So something causing it to begin to roll down the tracks. So
we also use the analogy, of course, of tossing in the air a whole pile of, millions of letters and letting them fall millions of times, and then eventually they would all fall, what would fall into place would be Shakespeare's Hamlet.
Right. So
that is, if there were no designer.
No designer.
No cause. Anyone to cause something to happen.
Okay. Both those, I think, are appealing to the imagination.
But both in the intelligent design and in the causation arguments, such a first cause or an uncaused cause or a prime mover would have to be God. And if we can prove there is such a first cause, we will have proved that there is a God. And as we said, there are several arguments that St. Thomas developed that we didn't actually go into the details of these.
I remember we spent a lot of time in philosophy at St. Mindred on those five arguments from reason that St. Thomas gave in the 13th century for that we could prove logically for the existence of God, but it certainly takes some time. So maybe you might say why we decided not to go in detail to discuss the five arguments from reason of St. Thomas for the existence of God.
Well, as we said in our last session, and I just repeated that a while ago, to go into Thomas's arguments would be fairly difficult without some visual aids and would require presenting an explanation of the syllogism, for example, which is a method of logical reasoning. And it was the syllogism was a major analytical tool used by theologians for centuries to better understand the Catholic faith. That is, I mean by that, of course, the doctrines of the Church. Also, as we said, this method of trying to understand revealed truth more deeply has always had its critics in the Church. But it came under attack, especially in the first half of the 20th century. And since Vatican Council II, it has become almost ceased being a theological tool. And there's another reason we decided to forego a discussion of this method for discovering the truth. Although it's still a valid method of seeking the truth, critics consider the method to be too rational and not experiential enough for the modern mind. And by experiential, I mean a method that stresses the importance of human experience. And in theology, this means the human experiences as found in the Bible when you read, you know, the stories of the Bible, the experiences of people at that time, the Israelites and others, a tradition found in tradition and the writings of the church fathers. Advocates of experiential methodologies also stressed the employment of modern philosophical methods to theological questions. Certain French theologians of the 1940s and 50s, and there were some German and Belgian too, call this return to the original sources of Catholic doctrine the ressourcement. This method of doing theology, or the nouvelle theology, or the what's called the new theology in English, and both Pope John Paul II practiced, and Pope Benedict XVI practices experiential methods in theology. And for example, in the case of John Paul, his personalism and the phenomenology that he applied to understanding more deeply the doctrines of the Church. The remaining arguments for God's existence that we're going to discuss are in the main experiential argument.
I believe it was true that Pope John Paul II, the Great, I like to call him, tried to frame the arguments given by Paul VI in his Humanae Vitae on human life in experiential theological reasoning, because he said seemed to reach modern man and woman better than sort of the old scholastic or the theological approach that was used pretty much up to that time against about artificial contraception, which was such an uproar, an explosion in the church when that came out. I believe it was 1967 or somewhere around there, Humanae Vitae. So, but wasn't it true that he tried to reframe the whole
especially
thing?
Especially in the theology of the body.
Theology of the body.
And the splendor of truth and some of the other.
He seemed to be a master at doing that.
Oh, yes.
reframing older theological arguments, as you mentioned, still valid, but put them in new language.
John Paul was trained as a Thomist. He studied, in fact, he got his doctorate in theology at the Angelicum, I believe it was, in Rome, under Father Reginald Guillaume Lagrange. And Lagrange was one of the greatest Thomists of the day, or the greatest scholastic or practitioner of the syllogism and that whole methodology. Yet at the same time, of course, John Paul did his doctorate on mystical theology, which, of course, Reginald Gregory Lagrange was also one of the world's greatest experts on mystical theology, and himself a very holy and mystical man.
He's deceased.
Many years, yes.
Okay. But so John Paul II, the Great, did his thesis, I believe, on the mystical theology of St. John of the Cross.
On St. John
the Carmelite.
Of the Cross, that's correct, yes.
Okay. Well, can we go on now to some of the other arguments that experientially try to reason towards the existence of a divine being, supreme designer, first cause, prime mover, or a beginner of all things?
Yes, by experiential, we just simply mean the experiences of human beings in their, you know, day-to-day lives. And there are quite a few of these arguments. And I'd like to start out here with Father Aidan Nichols, a Dominican priest and Englishman, who is one of my favorite theologians, and he discusses several other proofs for God's existence that I think are really worth mentioning. And he starts out with what he calls the experience of wonder. It's a wonder that there's a world in the first place.
It's just,
he goes on to state how we wonder at the beauty of a sunrise or sunset, the grace and prowess of athletes, or the complex operation of an organ such as the eye. The eye has been used an awfully lot by apologists, the complexity of the human eye.
It makes the most modern camera seem like a tinker toy.
Right. However, sometimes we generalize this sense of wonder, he tells us, and extend it to the fact that there is a world at all. And from this, there emerges the argument that since the world is not self-explanatory or self-sufficient, we must presume that there is a reason for it. And such a reason would have to be something. He calls this something a ground or a basis that's transcendent or above and beyond the world. In other words, that something must be greater than the world itself. And he concludes that the idea of the transcendent ground of the world is at any rate a part of what people mean by God. He uses some big language, you know, but that's what we mean essentially by God. This
I used to spend some time in Florida on the Gulf, and every night we would watch the sun go down. And I experienced at the time, no wonder the old Celts and people even in Mexico and the like worship the sun. It's so awesome. It's breathtaking.
The Egyptians, of course, were another.
Egyptians.
Amun-Ra.
And obviously the sun being the source of all life on the world, I can easily see that if I didn't have the Catholic faith, I could have become a sun worshiper.
Well, there is a connection in a sense, though, that Jesus is the light of the world, you know, and God is usually looked upon as light.
Saint Francis.
So they were part of the way on the right track.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was the beginning. Well, yeah. Even Saint Francis in his canticle canticle of the sun, said, Lord, the sun reminds us of you, light of the world. So that sense of wonder, I think many or most of us at one time or another have experienced that, and there's got to be something beyond our limited and tiny selves, such as we see in a setting sun. Okay, Father Nicholas, whom you quote an awful lot, this Englishman, would you want to say just a word about him? Why do you quote him so much?
Well, he's, as I said, he's a noted Dominican theologian and philosopher. He lives in England. I don't know if he's the abbot there or not. It's called the Black Friars.
Okay.
And he's quoted, so the reason I got on him, because he was quoted by so many theologians that I do highly regard. For example, Cardinal Avery Dulles would make reference to him, and who's an American theologian, and was made a cardinal by John Paul II because of his contribution to theology. And incidentally, he was the son of Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles.
Oh, John Foster Dulles.
Yes. And he's quite old now. He must be 90 years old, but I think he still does some teaching at Fordham. He was at Fordham for years there as a professor, you know.
He's a Jesuit.
Yes.
Okay.
But again, he was quoted by, and then of course when I started reading him, the first book I read of his was called The Shape of Theology, where he gives a history of theology. And absolutely, you know, magnificent book. And he's written several books on Newman and the new theology and things of that sort. So he's very orthodox, and yet he's very much into this. In fact, he's written a biography of Pope Benedict the 16th.
Really?
Yes. He actually had written a book on Cardinal Ratzinger before that.
Oh, really?
And he took that book and updated it when he became the Pope.
Wonderful. Okay, well, you just gave us, that's a nice background for Father Aidan Nichols, Order of Preachers, so Dominican. You just gave us his first discussion about wonder as a proof, experiential proof of something beyond ourselves as we see the wonders of the world. What else does he say? Any other arguments for God's existence from experience?
Well, he and Peter Kreft, which we'll be talking about, whom we'll be talking about later, and others, this is called the experience of moral obligation or the existence of conscience. Father Thomas DeBay, whom we quoted, I believe, in this series, I know we certainly did several times in some of the other series, he tells us that every normal adult has a sense of oughtness. We're just born with it.
I ought to do something, yes. Or I ought not to do something.
That he or she did not acquire this, and they can't shake it off. He says that it is imperious in its demands, and it operates whether he is observed by other human beings or not. And after some actions, he feels happy, that is, the person feels happy. After others, he feels guilty, and he cannot easily strip himself of these feelings. In this regard, he quotes a scientist by the name of Thomas Lewis as saying, quote, "As I understand it, a human being cannot tell a lie, even a small one, without setting off a kind of smoke alarm somewhere deep in the dark lobule of the brain, resulting in the sudden discharge of nerve impulses or the sudden outpouring of neural hormones of some sort or both. Lying then is stressful, even when we do it for protection or relief or escape or profit, or just for the pure pleasure of lying and getting away with it," end of quote.
That's a beautiful quote.
Yes, and then Lewis, and again, keep in mind, this is a scientist who studies such matters. Lewis goes on to say, lying, quote, is in a sure physiological sense an unnatural act. We are a moral species by compulsion. A moral compulsion can come only from a person, and in this case, the person must be a lawgiver over and above the human race. Who else could so speak? Newman was much impressed with this evidence, for the evidence of a supreme governor, the holy God of the universe. For him, conscience was the echo of the loving Lord speaking from the depths of each human person, end of quote. I think the efficiency in the, for example, a lie detector test is empirical proof that lying is unnatural. We call people who are inveterate liars psychopathic liars, which means that they have no conscience. And of course, that's a type of mental, you know, mental illness.
Aberration.
Yes.
Well, I think people at times who have committed murder, who were never found out, sometimes walked into a police station and said, "I want to confess because I can't live with this anymore." So it's that sense of something in us saying, right is right and wrong is wrong, and we say, well, that's the divine lawgiver, what Father Aidan Nichols is arguing.
Well, you know, even in our system of law, there's a recognition of this principle. A person commits a heinous crime or a series of heinous crimes, and it disturbs people when they're not sorry for it, when they're psychopathic about it, when they have no conscience, it doesn't bother them. Then people really, that really upsets people, far more so, 100 times more. Even the parents, let's say, who've lost a daughter who was murdered by some man, let's say, in a heinous way, it doesn't bring the daughter back, but at least if the man expresses some, expresses some sorrow, some, "I'm sorry I did this, you know, or I shouldn't have done that," or whatever, at least it helps some. But what really disturbs people when these people show no remorse and no conscience, in other words, and that's just totally unnatural.
Okay, that's another good example.
I think that the experience of moral obligation or the existence of conscience, I think that's a very important argument for God's existence. And there are times when we do things not necessarily required of us or even in our best interest, but we do them because we believe them to be the right thing to do. In fact, it would bother us if we didn't do them. And this is the voice of conscience, or you could say the voice of God, prompting us to do the right thing.
Okay, I think it's a strong argument, because most of us have experienced this still, quiet voice deep within saying, this is the right thing to do, or this is the wrong thing to do.
Oh, you know, we've seen the cartoon, you know, with the angel sitting on one shoulder, and then the little devil or demon sitting on the other, trying
right.
to get control of our conscience.
But that's much more profound than the cartoon would seem
to
indicate.
Certainly is.
Okay, well, What about, having talked about the existence of conscience, does Father Aidan Nichols give us any other proofs to think about to that we can reason?
Well, he tells us that the experience of our own dissatisfaction is proof of God's existence. In other words, he takes little things and, you know, makes a lot of it here. He says that dissatisfaction with any of the objects that we can acquire in this life is surely the greatest single source of religious belief. He says that we aren't programmed genetically to know at the beginning what objects will bring us satisfaction in life. And we can find these things out only by experience. And I think he's here talking about life's fundamental questions, though, such as, you know, what is the meaning of life, and where will I find lasting happiness, and not the satisfaction of our basic drives for food and water and intimacy and that type of thing. I think he's talking about more fundamental things. When we satisfy these basic drives, we're still left with life's fundamental questions. In other words, the need for food and clothing and shelter and satisfying these types of needs. We won't find lasting answers to these questions in this life. And if we can't find lasting answers in this life, then perhaps the goal of our striving lies outside and beyond this world, which various religions have considered an argument for God's existence. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church goes farther by far, I believe, than any other institution in the world to explain and gives us answers, satisfactory answers for these things. But even then, there's a point beyond which it's mystery. And so this unfulfilledness that we're going to have in this life can only be fulfilled by God, of course, in the next life.
I think poets have described it as there's a hole in the human heart that nothing else can fill. Augustine, the great writer, theologian, philosopher, and teacher of rhetoric, said, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless till they rest in you." And he had to learn that the hard way himself.
Oh, he certainly did.
He certainly learned that by experience.
Yes, I've quoted that many times. That's found in his Confessions somewhere.
Yes, it is.
He wrote that. That was, you know, where he was, his autobiography, essentially, and he was telling the story of his sinful life when he was a young man, and then, of course, the conversion that he experienced, and then how he lived, was at least trying to live a holy life as an adult, and, of course, a priest and a bishop. And
Well, eventually, the church canonized him,
yes.
Having been a great sinner, and he became a great saint, and that's why he's often held up to all of us that no matter how bad we've been, we can always make a new beginning and with the grace of God start over.
Well, I've heard the story how on his deathbed, I believe it was he on his deathbed would, for two or three days would just lay there hitting his breast saying the Jesus prayer, "Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner," probably remembering those sinful early years of his life.
Sure. I didn't know that incident in his life, but there are so many things to know about Augustine because he wrote this beautiful
yes.
confession, his autobiography. Well, Ron, that brings us to the end of our program right now. So we'd like to thank all those who are listening, and may God bless you always and in all ways.